Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now.
I'm glad you joined me to discuss my favorite topic, which is movies. As a reminder, the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees who are working at the station airing this broadcast, or the volunteers for that matter, or the station as a whole. And I have three brand new movies to review for you for this show, so I'm very excited about that. Of course, all the movie theaters probably around the world, definitely around the country, are closed. So I have no choice, like many of you, if I want to see new movies, to see them at home. And I've said this many times, and I don't mean to sound repetitive, but I prefer to see a movie in a theater. And seeing movies at home probably reminds me the big reason why I don't prefer to see movies at home. I think when I'm at home, not only are there a lot of distractions, but also sometimes it's either really early in the morning or really late at night, and I don't have time to sit down for a full hour and a half to 2 hours and watch one movie by myself. If anything, I feel more like watching TV shows. And I have been actually tempted. I feel sort of given into peer pressure to review streaming series or TV shows on the show Words on Film. And I have resisted so many times, and I'm still going to resist, because this is Words on Film, not Words on TV shows. So I'm going to restrict it reluctantly, more and more reluctantly as time goes on, to movies and not TV shows. But let me get into some of the movies that I have to review for you for this show. The first movie I'm going to review for you is a Netflix original that came out on April 22nd, 2020, which was, as of the recording of the show, this past Wednesday. The movie is called The Willoughbys. And The Willoughbys is actually based on a book that was written by Lois Lowry, who also wrote such young adult novels as The Giver. I remember reading The Giver when I was in junior high. That was an excellent book. And certainly very mature, or more mature than usual for a lot of young adult novels. But people like me in their 20s and 30s definitely remember The Giver, or reading that when they were in school, and of all ages. It was made actually into a decent film about 5 years ago, starring Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep, amongst other people. But if you've read the book, like I have, the movie usually doesn't compare to the book. I can't say the same for The Willoughbys. As a matter of fact, I'm not exactly sure if this was meant to be, or if Lois Lowry was writing it and she was envisioning this as an animated film. Somehow I doubt that. But as I was watching it, I kind of had the feeling that it was based on a book. I had that sneaking suspicion that it was. And the only reason I found out it was based on a book was after seeing the end credits. But seeing this film definitely reminded me of stories written by Roald Dahl, for instance. And the subject matter actually is kind of dark if you go past the bright colors of this animated film. So what is The Willoughbys about? Well, let me tell you. Convinced they'd be better off raising themselves, the Willoughby children hatch a sneaky plan to send their selfish parents on vacation. The siblings then embark on their own high-flying adventure to find the true meaning of family. So the Willoughby children in this case include the eldest son, Tim, who's voiced by Will Forte, his younger sister, Jane, who's voiced by Alicia Cara, and their twin brothers, both named Barnaby, and eventually later on in the film, they're called Barnaby A and Barnaby B, but why can they just give the other kid another name? I don't know. But those two children are both voiced by Sean Cullen. And Barnaby A and Barnaby B reminded me very much of Thing 1 and Thing 2 from The Cat in the Hat. Not just the Dr. Seuss book, but also that terrible terrible movie starring Mike Myers. So that is not a compliment. I just thought they were one-dimensional characters that didn't really do very much except kind of entertain kids who might be watching it, but they felt kind of like dangling keys in the sense that, yeah, they would entertain young people, but anybody older than maybe 3 years old would probably find them annoying. I know I certainly did. But these four children are kind of being raised by their parents, who are voiced by Martin Short and Jane Krakowski. And these parents are very Dickensian in the sense that even though they have the responsibility of raising children, they are more concerned with taking care of themselves. And they are so neglectful of their children that they actually, they eat fresh food whereas they serve their kids leftovers from yesterday, if they're lucky enough to leave leftovers. So eventually, Tim conspires with his sister and their two brothers, who, again, are kind of stupid characters, just those two brothers, and conspire to have their parents get killed. This is where the dark Roald Dahl or Lemony Snicket plot comes in. They don't intend to kill them themselves, but they actually send them on their parents on this very dangerous vacation. But eventually they find, even though they're very used to living on their own and actually are happier on their own, including under the watchful eye of a nanny who's voiced by Maya Rudolph, their parents still are surviving the vacation and actually loving it. So I'm not going to give away exactly what happens. I will say, however, that the Willoughbys, even though it is rated PG, is pretty dark for a movie that is as brightly animated as it is and is probably geared more towards children. If anything, I think the subject matter of these kids wanting their parents dead is a little too dark for a family film. But then again, the same sort of plot was there for many stories that I read as a kid, particularly by Roald Dahl, like George's Marvelous Medicine and James and the Giant Peach. And that didn't seem too dark for me. If anything, my parents, particularly my mom, was more worried about those stories than I was. But I guess it kind of shows that me being 37 years old and not a parent at the moment, but I guess it kind of shows that with maturity, I guess you tend to overthink things a little bit. But I also think that the Willoughbys, in spite of the subplot of these kids wanting their parents dead, is a bit tonally uneven. And I think that the animation in the movie, while it is beautiful, and certainly compares to the Aardman animation that brought us such stop-motion animated modern classics as Coraline and the Box Trolls, even though it is CGI animated, I just think that the animation didn't really fit what could have been the tone of the film. But with that said, I actually did enjoy it a lot. It is great to see a lot of talented actors and voice actors voicing the characters in this film. I didn't particularly care for Will Forte playing a kid, but I'll watch anything that Will Forte's in because he is a funny guy. Maya Rudolph is great as the voice of the nanny. I also really liked Terry Crews as the voice of a character named Commander Melanoff, who is this person who runs a candy factory, very much like a certain Roald Dahl book. And it's an unusual character both for Terry Crews to play and also for somebody who'd run a candy factory, but I thought that was one of the things that actually worked in this film. And to Terry Crews's credit, I could not tell that it was him when I was watching the film. So the Willoughbys, I thought, was enjoyable. It's not the best animated film I've seen even this year, but I thought it was serviceable, and it certainly worked better than even some theatrically released animated films that I've seen in past years, like Boss Baby and Ferdinand, both of which were undeservingly nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Oscars. They didn't win. They were kind of the underdogs, particularly behind the Disney Pixar film that was nominated that year that probably won. And I can't remember off the top of my head what that was, but in any event, I do think I would not be surprised that if the Willoughbys got nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Oscar ceremony, which hopefully, knock on wood, will take place less than a year from now. Hopefully the coronavirus in which we're living doesn't stretch on for that long. But the Willoughbys does get my rating of a checkout. It's uneven tone, particularly its potentially dark subject matter mixed in with the bright colors of this film, prevent it for me from becoming a great animated film. And there were also some annoying characters like the Willoughby twins Barnaby. And plus, the fact that they don't have separate names maybe shouldn't bother me as I think it probably should. But I just think those characters were just annoying. They were too reminiscent of Thing in One, Thing Two from The Cat in the Hat. And if they had distinctive personalities and maybe less annoying character traits, I probably would have enjoyed this film a little more. But I think kids will enjoy it and maybe won't overthink the dark subject matter of kids trying to kill their cruel parents. Indirectly, of course. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Tiger Tail. This is another Netflix original that is a little old. I mean, to many of you who don't watch films as frequently as I do, it's probably brand new, but it came out officially on Netflix on April 10th. And this is a film that, again, when I was telling you that I prefer to see movies in theaters, this is one of those films that I much would have rather seen in theaters in spite of the pandemic than sitting at home watching it. Because again, this is a movie that demands your undivided attention. I think that The Willoughbys is one of those films that kids might not mind being distracted by, and it does have a lot to hold your attention. But Tiger Tail does have a great story, but it's not quite as much of eye candy as The Willoughbys is. It is rated PG, though, interestingly enough, so it's not inappropriate for children, but it is certainly at a slower pace than I think a lot of children below the age of 12, I think, would understand or even appreciate. But Tiger Tail is a story that I believe is fictional about a Taiwanese factory worker who leaves his homeland to seek opportunity in America, where he struggles to find connection while balancing family and newfound responsibilities in this multi-generational drama. The director and writer of this film is Alan Yang, and Alan Yang is an Emmy Award-winning producer and writer. He's worked on such shows as Parks and Recreation as a producer, and he also produced Master of None. Both of these shows featured Aziz Ansari, the actor and comedian, but Master of None is the breakthrough sitcom, or rather the breakthrough comedy drama of Aziz Ansari. And unfortunately, Netflix is not making any new episodes of Master of None. I think it ran its course about 3 years ago, but if you want to check out Master of None, it is on Netflix currently, and it is unlikely that Netflix is going to pull that from its streaming rotation anytime soon. But Tiger Tail, unlike Parks and Recreation and Master of None, is not a particularly funny movie. I don't think there are any funny parts in it, actually. And That's okay. But it is a really good drama, which I think very well weaves the stories of past and present together, I think, flawlessly. And there is a lot of excellent cinematography. As a matter of fact, there's one scene in this film that takes place in Taiwan in the 1950s that shows this young Taiwanese worker who grows up to eventually immigrate to America. But in the meantime, he is actually in the very first scene running through a cornfield. And just that simple scene right there was brilliantly shot. In fact, I think the cinematography in this film is nothing short of amazing. And the actor who plays the Taiwanese factory worker, whose name is actually Grover, which is an unusual name for somebody who was raised in Taiwan, is an actor named Zima, who is not a particularly well-known name, Zima, but you've definitely seen him, or I assume you've seen him, in movies like The Farewell. In fact, that was the last film in which I saw him. And The Farewell was an excellent film that, surprisingly, at the Oscars, was nominated for absolutely nothing. But he also has been in other films, such as Arrival, which I saw back in 2016. I wasn't in love with that film, but maybe it's one of those films I need to revisit. I did think it was imaginative and very well acted, but it was just missing, to me, that X factor. And if it hadn't been for this pandemic, you probably also would have seen Zima in the movie Mulan, where he plays Mulan's father, Zhu. But the live-action remake of Disney's Mulan has been postponed for at least a couple more months. I do eventually hope to see the live-action remake of Mulan eventually, but for right now, I'm just streaming movies that haven't been delayed in theaters. And I also thought that Zima acted really well alongside his on-screen daughter in this movie, whose name is Angela, who's played by a young actress I don't think I've ever seen before named Christine Koh. So Angela and Grover, again, that name, that just bothers me. That Grover is not a Taiwanese name, but I guess it must be one of those adopted names. But in any event, Christine and Grover have a very fraught relationship in present-day America, and her name's Angela. The actress's name is Christine Koh, but Angela does not really know too much about her father and his early life in Taiwan. As a matter of fact, I guess he immigrated to America for the reason that I think everyone all around the world immigrates to America, because it is reputed to be the land of opportunity, quite understandably. But it is interesting that Taiwan is the Democratic Republic of China, as opposed to the mainland China, which is the People's Republic, the communist part of China. So I would imagine that there would be fewer people who were immigrating from Taiwan to America than from mainland China. But again, I suppose it happens. But that's really not important in the story. What is important is the story of this actually relatively unlikable old man who is estranged from his daughter, or not estranged, but has a very fraught relationship with her, and also married into who married someone for convenience as opposed to love. And there actually is a really good love triangle that occupies a good part of this film. And I'm not going to explain exactly how it ends, but I will say this, and this isn't spoiling too much. The character Grover actually divorces his wife after about 40 years. And of course, that is very uncomfortable to watch, but it is supremely well acted. And Zima does an amazing job acting in this film as an older man who went for what he thought he wanted by immigrating to America, but there's still something missing, even though he created a better life for his family. I think it's a fascinating movie, and I really hope that the Academy does not forget this film when they're considering nominating films either for Best Picture or for Best Foreign Film. And I say foreign film because I forgot the name of the category now. It used to be Best Foreign Language Film, but I think it's more Best International Feature, which widens the eligibility quite a bit, because English-speaking films that aren't from America would be eligible for that category. And Tiger Tail is a film that is in Taiwanese, Mandarin, and English. And I think it all weaves together incredibly well with some excellent cinematography. And I did mention before Alan Yang directed and wrote this film, and he's had extensive experience in television as a producer and as a writer. But this is actually his feature film debut. Before this, he directed one video short. It was actually, it's called a video short, but it's actually a music video from Jay-Z, and it's one called Moonlight, which is actually a really good music video if you haven't seen it. And surprisingly enough, even though it's Jay-Z's song, he's not in it. But it is a video that's at first really entertaining, but at the very end of it, it really makes you think. But Alan Yang, kudos to him for having such an impressive directorial debut as a feature film. I do kind of wish that this film had been, well, I wish this pandemic hadn't happened, but I do think this film would have been better suited for an art house cinema. But at the same token, I think that's my personal preference of watching films. The good thing about this being on Netflix is potentially millions more people could see it. But Tiger Tail is an excellent film, and it is a knockout for me. It has great acting, a really good story that's not linear, but the way it weaves sort of in and out of the past and present is really skillful, especially for a first-time director. And of course, there are moments in the cinematography, especially at the very beginning and the very end of this film, that is nothing short of mesmerizing. Listening to the show Words on Film. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is another Netflix original that was released on the same day as Tiger Tail, April 10th, 2020, and that movie is Love, Wedding, Repeat. This is a movie that reminds me actually quite a bit of Four Weddings and a Funeral, but it's an ensemble movie which has a lot of really talented actors, most of whom are British, but the movie gets a little weird when the repeat part happens. Let me explain. Here's the premise of the film. While trying to make his sister's wedding day go smoothly, Jack, the lead protagonist in this film, finds himself juggling an angry ex-girlfriend, an uninvited guest with a secret, a misplaced sleep sedative, and the girl that got away in alternate versions of the same day. Now, I do think this movie has it together when it comes to the wedding itself and certain things that I think worst case scenario could go wrong at weddings. But when the movie gets into the repeat part of it, where it sort of says, kind of like the movie Clue, this is how you saw it happen, but here's what really happened if A, B, and C happened first. That's where the movie kind of loses its way. And the unfortunate part about this film is it's literally about an hour into the film when the movie gets all supernatural, and Judi Dench actually makes a vocal cameo in this film as the narrator when things get really weird and really cataclysmic at this wedding. She pauses the film and says, "Here's how this would have happened if the seating arrangements were this way, but let's try to envision a scenario. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but she says, well, let's try to envision a scenario where people sit in opposite chairs. And that's when the film starts to really lose its way. At worst, it gets overly sentimental. At, I guess you could say, other worst, it also gets really weird. But the one thing I didn't really like about the film was the fact that, in addition to this out of nowhere, never mind, let's go back to the beginning subplot that happens that occupies the repeat part of this title, I thought Jack, the actor played by Sam Claflin, was the only really good, logical, fleshed-out character in this film. Of course, there are other characters that serve as good supporting actors, but overall, the movie is just so chaotic that the character of Jack, who's played by Sam Claflin, is the only one who really acts logically. And let me give you an example of this. There is a subplot in this film, amongst the many subplots and many actors in this film, where Jack, I keep on getting the actors' names and the characters' names mixed up. Jack has a sister whose name, gosh, there are so many people in this film. Her name is Haley, and she's played by Eleanor Tomlinson. Anyway, she's getting married to an Italian guy, and her ex-boyfriend shows up to the wedding and does something really crazy. First of all, he's literally high on cocaine. And secondly, he tries to do something which he thinks is overly romantic by trying to profess his love to the bride after she has taken her vows. Now, in reality, if this happened to a poor young woman, or poor woman, I should say, who's getting married, she would probably either get security or get one of the groomsmen to throw this guy out. But for some odd reason, she kind of tolerates it. And also, her groom, the guy she's marrying, actually gets really chummy with the guy for a moment and says, oh, you don't have to worry about that there aren't enough seats for you. There's probably one more at table X. And as I was watching this film, I was thinking, that is not realistic. If somebody is not invited to the wedding, there's nobody, I don't think, particularly the bride or the groom, would say, oh, come on, there's plenty of food and we'll get you a place to sit. That doesn't happen, especially at a wedding that looks as amazing as this one. And the wedding takes place in Italy at this old mansion, and this is probably the stuff that 5-year-old girls dream of when they think of their dream wedding. But I just thought there was too much chaos going on here, to the point where, and I like chaos, of course, and there are some actors here who are pretty funny. But again, that one subplot with the ex-boyfriend who's trying to win the heart of his ex-girlfriend who just got married, would some people do that? Oh yeah. I would say that there are men in this world who are obsessed and who are crazy enough to do that. I'm definitely not one of those people, but yeah, there are some psychotic people out there who would think of this as romantic rather than incredibly tacky, incredibly awkward, and lacking any kind of forethought or consideration. It's the bad kind of romance, the really bad kind. But that's the thing, not so much the supernatural element of it, although that was contrived as well, that really threw this thing in flux. And also, I did think that there were moments that of slapstick that just didn't make any sense. Like, for instance, Haley, the bride, convinces her brother Jack to slip something into her ex-boyfriend's drink to make him really sleepy. And Jack kind of fumbles this part as well and ends up putting this roofie, for lack of a better term, into the drink of the guy who is the maid of honor. And I didn't misspeak there. There's a guy here who's a maid of honor. And that is actually something that's becoming, it's unorthodox for weddings still, but it's becoming more increasingly common for guys to take the place of the maid of honor, but still be called something a little bit more masculine than maid of honor. But in any event, the maid of honor in this guy, in this film, whose name is Brian, who's played by Joel Fry, has a lot of quizzical moments in the bad sort of sense. He is, of course, falling asleep, and there are moments that are funny where he dozes off in his chair. And there's one particularly funny scene where kids at the wedding are putting mints in his mouth as he's lying there asleep. I thought that was funny. What wasn't funny, though, was where he's going up to the microphone to make his speech for the bride and groom. And for some inexplicable reason, I mean, he acts like he's drunk, which you would expect for somebody who had a roofie put in their drink. But then the cake gets put out, and a wedding cake in a comedy is kind of like a swimming pool. By that, I mean, whenever you see a swimming pool in a movie, particularly a comedy, you know somebody's going to fall into it. Same with a wedding cake in a comedy. When you see a wedding cake, it gets pushed out, and the more beautiful the cake is, you know someone's going to ruin that cake. So when you see this guy fumbling and trying to stay awake during his speech, you know he's going to do something bad to that cake. And he does, but it's just so uncharacteristic. He just walks off the stage, grabs a handful of the cake, and stuffs it in his mouth. And that seems particularly uncharacteristic of the character himself, A, and B, the fact that he's on a sedative, not a hallucinogen. So that's just one of several scenes in Love, Wedding, Repeat that really doesn't work. I did think Sam Claflin was good as the leading man, but again, the constraints of this screenplay, which is actually based on a motion picture called Plan de Table by Francis Neef, just doesn't work in this remake. I did think Sam Claflin was a good leading man, and actually he had some very good scenes with the woman he's trying to woo, who's a war correspondent named Dina, who's played by Olivia Munn, who, by the way, looks amazing in this film. I mean, everyone looks amazing in this film, but goddamn, Olivia Munn, whoo! But I gotta remember, I have a girlfriend whom I love dearly, who's watching this show. Hi. So, Love, Wedding, Repeat gets my rating of a strikeout. It's a movie that looks really good. It's a movie that has great actors in it, but there are people in this film who just act illogically, and with the exception of Sam Claflin's character, they're all kind of one-dimensional. The bride in this movie is always frantic, and that's another, actually, wedding comedy cliche that has to be eliminated as soon as possible. The bride being a bitch. It's this bridezilla stereotype where the bride is just so concerned about having the perfect wedding day that everything falls apart around her, and she starts showing the shrewd side of her. A side that is so shrewd, by the way, it is a wonder how the guy who is marrying her still wants to be married to her. It's this whole bridezilla thing, which, again, the show Bridezilla is entertaining, but it's not realistic, and I do wish that more wedding films would stop being so sexist towards either the bride or the bridesmaids. And I think the really good wedding comedies like Bridesmaids don't paint the bride out to be that kind of shrill person. So Love, Wedding, Repeat falls into a lot of those cliches. You know, the really ornate, ostentatious wedding that looks like it's on a Hallmark card, but again, there's chaos that ensues because of really stupid characters. That's what Love, Wedding, Repeat is, and while I didn't hate it, I can't recommend it either.
Thank you.
I have reviewed all the new films I have seen for this week, but I try to do a minimum 3 new films to see for this week. Maximum is probably about 5, although I put in the maximum before there was a pandemic where I could take for granted that there are box office numbers that are being put out every week, but there haven't been any box office numbers that have been put out for the last 5 weeks, and understandably so. But it's going to be a while before I do my first segment, What's Topping the Box Office. That's the way I normally started the show, and I ended the show with what's coming up next. But truth be told, it is much harder to find out what's coming out next through the channels I usually find, like IMDb or Apple Movie Trailers, then it's harder now since there aren't films that are coming out in theaters. But I just see what's new, and I come up here and I tell you exactly, you know, what I've seen and what's coming up next, whether or not I will see it. But I can tell you, however, the movies that have come out on DVD, Blu-ray, and in some cases, 4K. And unfortunately, a lot of these films I haven't seen, so I can't exactly recommend them to you, but I can at least tell you what they are. One film that came out in January that is now out on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K is a film called The Gentlemen, which was directed by and written by Guy Ritchie. It stars Matthew McConaughey as drug lord Mickey Pearson, and when word gets out that he's looking to cash out on the business, When word gets out that he's looking to cash out on the business, it triggers plots, schemes, bribery, and blackmail. I didn't write that synopsis, which is why I got tripped up from the fact that they didn't include a comma after the word business. But The Gentleman has an all-star cast that includes Matthew McConaughey, as I mentioned. It also co-stars Hugh Grant, who I don't believe had been in a Guy Ritchie film before this, surprisingly enough. But Hugh Grant is one of those people you'd see more in romantic comedies than you would in action films. But still, The Gentleman is not a film I can recommend because I haven't actually seen it. But I can tell you it is out on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. I remember the reviews being pretty good, especially for a film that was released in January. Because January, for those of you who don't go to the movies as much during January, has the very best in movies, i.e. the films that are potentially nominated for Oscars and are at first released in select theaters or select cities, I should say, around Christmas time. And select cities usually means New York and LA, maybe San Francisco. It doesn't mean other big cities like Boston, Chicago, or even Nashville, where I am right now. But The Gentleman, I heard, was not one of those films that was destined to be nominated for an Oscar, but it is one of those films that actually was one of the better ones that came out in January. And sometimes it actually is kind of fun to go to theaters and watch a really bad film in January, just to see the dreck they couldn't release in the summer or the winter. But The Gentleman's not one of those films, it's just one I haven't seen. The other film that I haven't seen, but is available right now on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K, is Bad Boys for Life, which is the third Bad Boys film, and came out literally 17 years after Bad Boys 2, and 25 years after the original Bad Boys. But Will Smith and Martin Lawrence are back together again, and this movie was a huge box office hit. Will Smith reprises his role as Miami Detective Mike Lowry, and Martin Lawrence reprises his as Marcus Burnett. And they are together for one last ride to bust a pair of drug lords who wreak vengeful havoc on their city. So I can't tell you how this film is. Maybe this is one of those films that I will rent, or I probably won't buy it, especially on Blu-ray, because I don't feel like paying $23, if I'm lucky, for a film I haven't seen and I have no idea if it's good or not. I would assume it's good considering how much money it made at the box office, but I can't exactly say for sure. But Will Smith and Martin Lawrence are two actors who, I think in the 90s, they were polar opposites. Will Smith was more family-friendly than Martin Lawrence, and Martin Lawrence was known as a comedian who said things that made Andrew Dice Clay blush. But he's toned down over the last 20 years. And some people might say for the worst, but at least his style of comedy won't get him kicked off of Saturday Night Live now like it did in the mid-90s. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, look it up. There's another film that's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, not 4K. It's a film called The Turning, which also came out in January of this year. And it's a movie about a young governess who is hired by a man who has become responsible for his young nephew and niece after their parents' death. The movie is described as a drama horror mystery, and the cover of the movie has this girl who is looking straight at you in a very sinister way, and she has there are these hands that probably aren't hers. They look way too big to be hers, and they're doing her hair, and it's a really creepy effect, but not nearly as creepy, I might add, as the poster for the 2010 movie Orphan. That poster is scary. Now, the film itself is not altogether that bad. There are some scary moments, but my God, the poster for Orphan is terrifying. It's just me and pictures of people who A, aren't smiling, and B, look directly at the camera, symmetrically. There's something about that, and I don't know what it is, but it completely freaks me out. And if it just flashes onto my computer or television screen, it instantly makes my heart jump. It's a good thing I don't have heart problems. But anyway, this movie, The Turning, has actually a lot of really good actors in it. It has Mackenzie Davis, who I've seen in a number of films recently, including The Martian, and she's a really good actress. I have the feeling that she's going to be nominated for something very soon in her later movies. The movie also co-stars Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things, who was also in both It films, and he was really good in all those things. And the creepy little girl who's in the poster and in the movie is actually a young actress by the name of Brooklyn Prince, who many of you, those of you who scour out independent movies, would probably know best from the movie The Florida Project. And The Florida Project is a movie that came out in 2017, which I absolutely loved. When I was doing my top 10 list back in 2017, I did not include The Florida Project in my top 10 of the best movies of 2017, but rest assured, it came really close. Brooklyn Prince was excellent in that film, as was, of course, Willem Dafoe, who was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for the movie. And he actually got the only Oscar for that film. And just to get off on a little bit of a tangent, there was also a woman in the film who played Brooklyn Prince's mother, who's an actress named Bria Venati. And she had never acted in a film before The Florida Project. In fact, I think Brooklyn Prince, who was, I think, 7 at the time of the film, had more acting experience than she did, but everyone in that film did an amazing job. And I have been talking about Netflix because that's the only streaming service to which I subscribe. The Florida Project is not a Netflix original, but it is out on Netflix right now. And while I can't recommend The Turning because I don't know whether that movie is great or not, I can tell you, I can recommend The Florida Project. It is an amazing film. And it's one of those films that I saw way back when, and it's one of those films that's kind of stayed with me. As a matter of fact, when I was donating platelets last weekend, and I had access to whatever Netflix films I wanted, I saw The Florida Project again, and I was even more mesmerized by that film the second time I saw it than the first time. It is an amazing movie, and shot on a shoestring budget. And when I see a young actor or actress who is as talented as Brooklyn Prince, I have mixed feelings. First of all, it's great to see somebody as talented as that on the big screen who doesn't look like they are actually acting, and that is an asset. But at the same time, I really, really, really hope that they don't grow up to become former child stars. And I'm not talking about people like Ron Howard, Kurt Russell, or Joseph Gordon-Levitt, people who actually not only succeeded in their adult life, but succeeded in the entertainment industry, which is even harder. But they are the exceptions to the rules. The real rules about former child stars are actually quite tragic, and they don't seem to change over 50 years. These former child stars either get into drugs or DUIs, or they get or they have stints in the porn industry. It's really awfully sad. And Macaulay Culkin particularly didn't fall into that, but still, his life as at least a teen or an early adult was pretty tragic. He's doing okay now, but, oh man, some of the things that his family went through, and particularly the things his father put him through, I wouldn't wish on anybody, most especially myself. But getting back onto the topic of recent DVD and Blu-ray releases, The Turning, that drama and horror film, is out on DVD and Blu-ray right now. It probably is also available on streaming if you want to check it out. Probably on platforms like Amazon Prime, probably not on Netflix or Hulu, at least not yet. Listening to the show Words on Film. I also want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of yours truly, your host and movie critic Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees or volunteers who are working at the station airing this broadcast or the station as a whole. With that said, I am kind of out of things to talk about right now. I'm not really, but I do have to contrive what I'm going to talk about for the last section of this film. I guess I can just go into the best movies on Netflix right now. And these are not necessarily movies that are brand new, but those of you who have Netflix and want to check out some movies, I can recommend to you some more classic films, or at least I could just go through the list that I found on Vulture.com right here. There is one film that came out that is described as a teen epic. It came out in 2016. It's called American Honey, and this is a film I reviewed when it came out. It's a film that I think is well shot to a certain extent. It's a movie about a runaway who's played by Sasha Lane, who is a very talented British actress who plays an American very convincingly in this film, but she finds herself a part of a crew of young people bouncing their way across the country. And it's described by Vulture as the best movie on Netflix you probably haven't seen. I wouldn't go as far as to say it's the best movie I have seen it, but it's not one of the best movies out there. I think it is a tad overrated. I think the good parts of this film are that it feels like a documentary as opposed to a film that's acted. And I think the fact that Shia LaBeouf is in this film, who is good in this film, I might add. Shia LaBeouf's gotten a lot of flack over the last couple of years, but he is actually a really good actor when he puts his mind to being a good actor. He's in this movie. Elvis's granddaughter, Riley Keough, acts in this film as well. And these people don't look like they're acting. This is very much like a Larry Clark film, even though it's directed by a woman named Andrea Arnold. But this film feels real, and I can appreciate for that. The reason I don't consider it a great movie is because it is way too long. It's 2 hours, 20 minutes, and I think that they could have cut 50 minutes, that's 5-0, out of this movie, and I think it would have been perfect. But it was a little too overlong, especially for a film that is a slice-of-life narrative and one that doesn't really particularly tell a story. But if you want to check it out on Netflix and maybe see whether I'm right or wrong, go ahead. Another movie that's out on Netflix right now that probably will be available for streaming for a long time is the 1997 classic As Good As It Gets. And this is actually the last movie so far to have won the Oscar for Best Actor in a Leading Role, Jack Nicholson, and Best Actress in a Leading Role, Helen Hunt. It's really hard to believe, but since 1998, when As Good As It Gets won those two particular awards, no other film in Oscar history since then has won Best Actor or Best Actress. Now, As Good As It Gets was not destined to win Best Picture. That award, not surprisingly, went to Titanic. And even though Titanic is not a perfect film, really there is no perfect film, but I think that enough effort went into making a replica of the Titanic and bringing this story, this tragic story, to life. I think enough time and effort, not just money, although there was that, was put into that movie so that Titanic, I think, deserved to win Best Picture. If it had won any of the acting categories, then I would have said maybe they didn't deserve to win that. But I'm still sticking to Titanic deserving to win Best Picture. And it's one of those things where it's popularity breeding contempt. And As Good As It Gets, along with Good Will Hunting and The Full Monty that year that were nominated for Best Picture, were definitely the underdogs, but they were more likable underdogs. And maybe I would have been happier if Matt Damon had won Best Actor for Good Will Hunting, but then again, Jack Nicholson certainly deserved it for As Good As It Gets, and it was his third Oscar, his second Oscar for Best Actor in a Leading Role. The other Oscar he won for Best Supporting Actor was in Terms of Endearment, which was also very deserved. But As Good As It Gets, that is an excellent rom-com, and it's certainly very much unlike most other rom-coms. It's one that I recommend. Again, rom-coms tend to be very formulaic, and if you don't believe me, you haven't been watching a lot of romantic comedies, particularly those that come out on Lifetime or the Hallmark Channel. In fact, pretty much the Hallmark Channel unabashedly uses the same formula over and over again. But movies like As Good As It Gets, especially directed and written by James L. Brooks, who brought us Broadcast News, does something a little different with it. And Broadcast News is another film that gets the attention it deserves. That's one that starred Albert Brooks, Holly Hunter, and William Hurt, amongst other people. It did feature also a cameo by Jack Nicholson. And that's a film that's excellent, but As Good As It Gets has some great performances in it, not just by Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt. I liked Cuba Gooding Jr. in it for the moments he's in the film. Greg Kinnear is great in the film. He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Unfortunately, he was up against Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting, and Robin Williams deserved to win that one, but Greg Kinnear was excellent in As Good As It Gets, playing a character he hadn't played before and had only played a few times ever since. In other words, Greg Kinnear is a good actor, but I think usually he gets typecast into being either A, a nice guy, or B, a guy who's really smug but has that facade of being a nice guy. And As Good As It Gets was the first film that Greg Kinnear was in, but not the last, where he didn't fall into either of those categories. He actually played a struggling gay painter. And you wouldn't expect, I wouldn't have expected at the time, Greg Kinnear to play such a role, but he plays it so well in this film. So, if you have not seen As Good As It Gets, get on it. It's on Netflix now. I highly recommend that one. If I was hosting this show back in 1997, I would not only give this movie a knockout, it would probably be one of my top five favorite films of the year. There are other films also that are on Netflix that are worth streaming. This is one on Vulture's list of the 100 best movies on Netflix right now that is the first mentioned Netflix original. This is a film that's a Western anthology by Joel and Ethan Coen, and it is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I loved this film. I reviewed this back last year when I didn't include it in my top 10 best films of the year, but again, that's really hard to pick 10 films I love because eventually I just have to decide which ones are the best of the best of the best. And The Ballad of Buster Scruggs didn't quite make it, but I loved its approach to the anthology film. And it had It certainly had a flavor to it where the films, all of which were directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, all felt different. There was the movie musical that reminded me of a Roy Rogers film. There was another one that reminded me of a Cormac McCarthy novel. And it's not the first film that Joel and Ethan Coen directed that was a Western, but it really just kind of pains me that Joel and Ethan Coen direct such high-quality Westerns, yet the Western is still kind of considered a dormant movie genre right now. But if you really look at films, particularly those directed by the Coen brothers or Quentin Tarantino, and as well as others, there are quality Westerns out there. You just have to look. But fortunately, with The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, you don't have to look too far. And I also, as I'm thinking about that film, I'm remembering the song that Tim Blake Nelson sings in that film, which was so good, it was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Song in a Movie. It didn't win. I can't remember what won in 2018, or at least not off the top of my head, because I don't have that list with me, but it is a really cool song that I think somebody like Roy Rogers would have definitely sung in his prime, or somebody like Jimmy Dean. But Ballad of Buster Scruggs is an excellent anthology film. I actually think they don't make enough anthology films nowadays, but I give kudos to Joel and Ethan Coen for thinking outside the box and doing a film that's certainly a tribute to the old Westerns, but also has its own originality to it, both in story and in presentation. So The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is a film that I can say with confidence will not be taken off of Netflix anytime soon. I can't say the same for American Honey or As Good As It Gets, but one thing I know is that Netflix, especially when it comes to streaming, holds on to its originals. So if you have not seen The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, that's another one I recommend entirely. And while I am going down this list, and I only have a limited time to go, but I will just give another plug to another film I saw, Blade Runner. Of course, I don't think that Netflix has the director's cut to Blade Runner, which originally, Ridley Scott directed and presented to studios, but of course, the studios thought it was too long, and Ridley Scott had to make some reluctant cuts to it, and it unfortunately did not help Blade Runner in the short run, because even with the edited hour-and-a-half cut that was released to theaters in 1983, Blade Runner was originally a commercial failure. But it's one of those films that was saved from cult followings and probably definitely videotape sales. It was certainly a movie that was ahead of its time, although thank God 2020 did not turn out the way that Ridley Scott semi-predicted that it would in this film. But it's still an amazing story, and its sequel is also surprisingly good as well, with actors like Sean Young, Harrison Ford, and Edward James Olmos reprising their roles, but also getting new blood like Ryan Gosling into that film as well. So I'm going off on a tangent, but there's a reason for that. I am running out of time.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.